It's good to think of Ezra chapter 10 as the comma before the continuation into the book of Nehemiah, which we probably may as well go ahead and do once we get to that point, because in the original Hebrew scroll, of course, both Ezra and Nehemiah are a single scroll and kind of meant to be part one and two of much of the same story. So I thought I'd mention that as we go along in the case that we get through chapter 10 today. Chapter 9, as we mentioned last time, is an important chapter to understand properly and understand well. It deals primarily with one of the things that the Jews and the Benjamites found themselves in the midst of after the return. This event took place apparently just a few months, it seems, from the chronology after Ezra returned. And so he's addressing an issue that had been going on probably since the very first captives came back from Babylon quite a bit earlier than Ezra's time, but nonetheless had continued on to this time and needed to be addressed. So let's take a look at that. The problem is one of spiritual intermarriage. And we'll address that here as Ezra goes through the circumstances that he faced. In verse 1, "Now when these things were done, the princes came to me." So Ezra's recording, here's what was brought to my attention after I'd been there for several months. It says, "The princes came to me saying, 'We've got a problem.'" Now, I just added that. "Houston, we have a problem." So they're now coming to the boss, the person who's been given responsibility over the area by the government, saying, "We've got a problem here. We need to address this." Now, before I address this problem along with Ezra, I want to be sure that everyone understands that there's nothing personal about this. As we go through this section of Scripture, we're not thinking about anyone in particular here or in anyone particular in any other congregation. We're not trying to point fingers or throw stones. We'll simply explain it as the Bible does, and we'll sort through it that way. But we don't want to make anyone particularly feel bad about their circumstances that they may currently be in. So the princes came, in the middle of verse 1, the people of Israel, and they said, "The people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands, doing according to their abominations." So what were these princes, the leadership, some of the leaders, bringing before Ezra? They said, "We've got a serious problem." One of the things, there were two primary issues, we might back up to that, that brought about the captivity of Judah to begin with. Ezekiel, Jeremiah, both strongly talk about how Israel had, number one, broken the Sabbath, and number two, gone into idolatry, worshiping in pagan ways in the area. And those two primary reasons were the purpose for the captivity. That's why the punishment came. And so in this case, they're saying we've got problem number two still in existence that we have a difficulty with. Something's wrong here. So it says they've not separated themselves from the people of the land, doing according to their abominations, even of the Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Ammonites, Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. What is interesting is that this list is now larger than it was previously in the Bible. It adds the Egyptians, because now the whole Egyptian issue is in the middle of this. Some people had gone back to practicing some of the religious practices of the Egyptians, so as well as the other pagan peoples that surrounded the area. So that's what we have as a problem. There are still a number of people who are participating in pagan religious practices. They've not separated themselves from the land. Now, again, it was not unusual in this time period, nor is it unusual today, for people to have mixtures of religious understanding, bits and pieces from lots of things. In fact, it's very popular today. We'll talk about that actually a little bit later. Where we draw, one person might say, "Well, I'm a Catholic, but they also speak in tongues, which is not a Catholic doctrine." They've got pieces and bits from various religions that they put together for their own religion. So these people that are being discussed here that hadn't separated themselves from the land, it's not that they were outrightly doing all the pagan worship ideas or practices, but they were doing some of them. So they may worship God on the Sabbath and then go sprinkle their field according to a pagan sex rite to try to get their crops to grow better. Those are the kind of things that might have been going on, this mixture of religious practices. And that's the kind of thing, of course, that led Judah to become captive in the first place. God said, I've had enough of that. You're disobedient to me. You're following other gods. I'm done with you. You're going to captivity. So it was an issue that was important that needed to be addressed. So we might say the issue was fidelity to God, and it was expressed through their marriages. And we'll talk about that as we go along. Here's how it expressed itself. They haven't separated themselves. They've allowed themselves to take these pagan practices. How did that happen? Verse 2. For they have taken of their daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the people of those lands. In other words, now they're explaining, how did this come to be? How did it happen? Well, it happened by spiritual intermarriage, by marrying someone who was not of the same faith, not of the same religious practice. So the problem, we've got pagan religious practices going on amongst some of our people. How did it come to pass? How did it happen? Well, they intermingled with the people, started to learn these things, and as a result, began to practice these things. So the issue then, how do we fix it? Well, we deal with these spiritual intermarriages. The problem is in the middle there. So the holy seed has mingled themselves, in the middle of verse 2, with the people of those lands. Yes, the hand of the princes and rulers has been chief in this trespass. So they basically put the blame where it belonged. Some in leadership positions were doing these things, and that encouraged others to do them as well. So it is true that good leadership can be a very good influence on people. Bad leadership can be a very bad influence, and it gives people excuses to do sometimes what they want to do, because they can point at somebody above them and say, see, so-and-so is doing, therefore I can do as well. Bad reasoning, every tub sits on its own bottom, or everyone's responsible for themselves, but that's certainly what sometimes happens. So Ezra was shocked. He was honestly shocked that this could have been taking place. Now, the reason we say it's just a few months after that this had to be going on before is because there are already children around from these marriages. And apparently these children being taught by their mothers were participating in pagan religious practices as well, the practices of the nations around. So verse 3, Ezra says, when I heard this thing, I tore my garment and my mantle and plucked off the hair of my head and my beard and sat down astonished. Now, some have questioned, did he really rip out his own hair, or is that just a colloquial expression? Now, I've been tearing my hair out over this thing. Well, it looks like I have, but that's beside the point. So we don't honestly know if this was a colloquial expression. I'm yanking my hair. Or if it was literally what the case was. My personal opinion, I have trouble thinking it was literal, but who knows? Maybe it was. But the point was, he was shocked. That what were the two reasons primarily we went into captivity? Idolatrous worship and Sabbath breaking. Ezekiel especially mentions that very clearly. So how can people, as soon as they get planted back in the promised land, as soon as they're shown grace and favor by God, how could they be back involved with those things? He was astonished that it could be the case. And he was discouraged as well. Verse 4. Then were assembled unto me every one that trembled at the words of the God of Israel, because of the transgression of those that had been carried away. And I sat astonished until the evening sacrifice. So he kind of collapsed in this disbelief and this depression almost of, I can't believe that people would be involved with this. Practicing pagan religious practices just didn't occur to him that it could have happened so quickly. Verse 5. At the evening sacrifice I arose from my heaviness, having torn my garment and my mantle, I fell upon my knees and spread out my hands unto the Eternal my God. So you see this picture of Ezra just mourning before God, and now he's recording the prayer that he actually prayed before God that day. Now, I would imagine this is a stylized version. I mean, he's pouring out his heart to God, then he sits down later and writes it out. These are the main points that he was concerned about. So again, it's a humble prayer. It's a beautiful prayer. It's one of the longer prayers in the Bible recorded. So I think we can learn a lot from it as we go through about our prayers as well. Verse 6, and said, here's what I had prayed about. O my God, I'm ashamed and blush to lift up my face to you, my God, for our iniquities are increased over our head, and our trespass is grown up into the heavens. Again, the issue was, here are Israelites, Jews and Benjamites, practicing pagan religious things. They were influenced by the intermarriage with those spiritually who were not part of God's way. And he said, this iniquity is like way over our heads. We are in way over our heads, we might say today. Verse 7, since the days of our fathers, we have been in great trespass unto this day. Ezra had a good feel for the history of Israel. And of course, his own peoples of the Jews and the Benjamites. And he realized that that's been our tendency all along, to water down, to take on practices that are not godly, and basically be comfortable with doing pagan religious worship as a part of our worship. So he said, ever since we began, it's been that way. Now, he may be referring back to the time of Moses coming out of Egypt. Certainly could have been going back before that. There are examples. But when Moses brought the Israelites out of Egypt, within how many days were they building the golden calf and dancing around it? He said, we've been in a mess since the start. Then it goes on to say, kind of the shocking statement as well, our priests have been delivered under the hand of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, to spoil, and confusion of face as it is this day. In other words, as a result, back up to the middle of verse 7. Get that whole phrase. For our iniquities, we have our kings, our priests, they've been delivered to the hand of the kings of the land, to the sword, to the captivity, to a spoil, and to confusion of face as it is to this day. So as a result of this idolatry, the whole nation has been taken captive from the top right down. Verse 8, and now, for a little space, grace has been showed from the Eternal our God to leave us a remnant to escape. Out of all this history, constant problems that were brought about by infidelity to God, we've got this small window here that we've been shown grace and favor, and what do? We go back to the same old sins. I like the way Ezra states it. It's a very instructive. He says, now for a little space grace has been shown us from our Lord God to leave us a remnant to escape and to give us a nail in this holy place. In other words, it wasn't a huge building. It's kind of like a tack on the wall. We got a handhold now. It wasn't a foothold. It wasn't an ability to climb. We just got this nail. All right, we're holding on by the skin of our teeth, by this little nail on the rock wall. That's the impression of what he's saying here. We got this little start, and if we could, you know, kind of make this hole bigger, we can get our hand in there, then we can get our foot in there, then we can get going again. So we got this little nail in this holy place, this small spot. Other translations render it a pin. He's got this little pin prick, and that's all we've got, just a little bit, and we're about to throw that away as well. That our God may lighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage. We've got this small, tiny little start. Verse 9, for we were slaves, bondmen. Yet our God has not forsaken us in our bondage, but has extended mercy unto us in the sight of the kings of Persia, to give us a reviving, to set up the house of our God, and to repair the desolations thereof. and to give us a wall in Judah and Jerusalem. So God's protection was what Ezra enjoyed the most, the fact that God would protect them. And he would allow them to build a physical wall so that they would have the physical means of protection as well. So we've gotten such a wonderful start. We've got this little spot, got a few people back. Yeah, the majority are still back in Babylon. We've got this small foothold here. And he was just so sad that it was being compromised. Verse 10. And now, O our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments. So it's interesting that there's this little foothold. We know that you've blessed us with this. You've shown us great mercy. And now look, what can I say? What can I say? We've broken, we've forsaken your commandments. Now, two of the Ten Commandments very clearly talk about Sabbath breaking and idolatry. So Ezra's referring back to the fact these two things for which we went into the Babylonian captivity to begin with are now a part of our routine again. Now you have to ask, how widespread was this? Chances are, as we'll come to see, it was a very small group of people. And yet, does that matter, that it was a small group? Leaven in the bread is a small little bit. What happens? Spreads. Absolutely. So what he was concerned about, even though it may have only been a small group at this point, and we'll see why we think that as we go along, it nonetheless was leaven in the bread. And if this was acceptable in this group and amongst some of the leadership, then who's to say it wouldn't just continue to increase and lead exactly back to where it was before captivity, where on a whole scale, most people are involved with these pagan practices. That was the concern. So fidelity to God is a vital issue. It is important as one we're concerned about. Verse 11. We've forsaken your commandments, the end of verse 10, which you have commanded by the servants, the prophets, saying, the land into which you go to possess it is an unclean land with the filthiness of the people of the lands, with their abominations, which have filled it from one end to the other with their uncleanness. Now, certainly this was in the prophets. These were things that Moses said as a prophet as well. So the land you're going into is a beautiful land, but it's filled with idolatry. It's an unclean land. It was described as a land that kind of eats people up, draws them into these pagan practices, and then spits them out, as we might say. Well, let's pause there for a moment when we get to that point, and to say, what exactly was Ezra referring to? What other sections of Scripture is he referring to say, we've broken your commandments? If you turn with me to Exodus chapter 34. Exodus chapter 34, and you might take that card back out of the front of your Bible and slip it into Ezra. We'll come back there in a short bit. Exodus chapter 34. What did God command his people as they were going to go into the promised land, into this set-aside property just for Israel? As Ezra said, God said it was an unclean land. Was it dirty? Well, no, it was unclean because of the practices that were going on, the pagan practices. Here in Exodus 34, we'll read in verse 14 to start. Maybe we should back up just a little bit more to get the context of the pagan practices going on. Verse 11 says, observe you that which I command you this day. Behold, I drive out the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite. And remember we mentioned the Egyptians were added to this list as well, their practices in Ezra. Verse 12, take heed or be careful to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, where you're going, lest it be a snare in the midst of you. In other words, this close agreement with the other peoples who have a completely different religious practice, making a peace treaty with them is a bad idea. Now, is being at peace with pagan people a bad idea? Well, no. But when you talk about making a covenant with them, anciently, what was that all about? What were these covenants usually ratified with? Usually ratified with marriages between each of the peoples. Mixing of the peoples. And the idea is, once you have a peace treaty, and now you have intermingled families, we're not going to attack you, because if I come and attack you, I'm killing my own grandchildren or nephews and nieces. And so the idea was to mix these things. So Moses is saying here back in Exodus, do not make a covenant with these people. Do not mix in this way, because it will be a problem. It'll be a snare for you. You'll end up leaving worship of the true God. Now what's interesting to especially note is that leaving worship of the true God does not typically happen all at once. It happens in pieces, in stages, where we give up certain things, but we're still basically doing it God's way, but we're giving up certain things, or we're taking on certain other things. And we're still worshiping God on the Sabbath, but now we're going to Sunday morning services as well to please our spouse, possibly. So there's this mixture that starts to go on, and we get acceptable. This is kind of acceptable. And well, they're nice people. Yeah, they may be quote-unquote pagans, but they're kind. They're happy. They sing nice songs at their services. So you start thinking, well, you know, it's really not that bad. So Moses was warning them that you get involved with that, making those kind of covenants, you'll end up in trouble. Verse 13, but you shall destroy their altars, break their images, and cut down their groves, all these religious areas. For, verse 14, you shall worship no other god. Don't mix things together. You can't be here on Sabbath and somebody else Sunday morning. It just isn't right. You shall not worship any other god. For the Eternal, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. There is a right kind of jealousy. We've talked about that before. Verse 15, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go a-whoring after their gods, and do sacrifice unto their gods, and one call you, and you eat of his sacrifice. In other words, you just don't get involved with that. They'll have their religious party. You've got this agreement with them. Say, look, if you're at peace with us, if you're in agreement with us, come on to our ceremony. Well, no, I don't do that. Well, what do you mean? We've got this peace treaty. Are you saying you're not peaceful with us anymore? And all of a sudden, you've got these complications. And you can see where this is leading. If you decide to marry someone of a different religious faith, what will happen? Will there be no pressure whatsoever to be drawn in that direction? Well, I think we'll see what Ezra was concerned about. Verse 16, and, you know, you make this covenant with these other people, you allow this, you take of their daughters unto your sons, and their daughters go a-whoring after their gods, and make your sons go a-whoring after their gods. You shall make no molten gods. In other words, Moses understood something. God understood it, obviously. And fellows, we don't like to admit this, but our wives have a tremendous influence upon us. Tremendous influence. And that influence can either be for good, or that can be for evil. And in this case, there's a great power in that marital relationship that has to be exercised very carefully and in a very spiritual manner, to encourage, to build up, to teach, to do all the things that a wife does. Oh, I know I said teach. Wives aren't supposed to teach. Well, they do. They teach us all kinds of good things, and that's very biblical, that's very scriptural. There's a yielding to one another in marriage that is very important. So, what was happening here, what Moses was concerned about, is you make this contract, this peace treaty first. Then you exchange kids. My kid's going to marry your daughter, and then our nation will be fine. And some of the higher ups in the government will marry each other's children so that we have this combine together. And as those daughters, it says here, could have been sons as well, but as those daughters go off and do their pagan practices, ever had a woman you love say, sweetheart, can't you please, dot, dot, dot. Oh, it would mean so much to me. I'm trying to imitate this because I've never heard this from my wife. Couldn't you please just, how do you resist that kind of thing? Well, all right. Or it's, if you don't, and you got the other extreme, which is probably harder to deal with, which I've never heard either. But that pressure is huge. And Moses realized that that's a huge power that's going to happen. And so it's going to draw people into false religious practices. And what happened in Israel? What did Solomon do? Solomon is recorded in what? 1 Kings 11 or 2 Kings 11? As having how many wives? Concubines? Hundreds? 1,000 total maybe of both? What did he do? He ended up using Israelite tax money to build pagan temples in Jerusalem. Moses knew it would happen. That's why he said this. That's why God inspired him to say it. You mix those things together and look out. You cannot completely stay apart from it. Be nice if you could. But you put yourself together in that close relationship and it will rub off. Not might. It's a matter of how much. So he says, don't do it. Do not mix yourself in this way. You will end up with trouble. Notice over in Deuteronomy chapter 3. That was Exodus. Deuteronomy now written to the group that was going to go in to the promised land. 40 years have basically passed of wandering in the wilderness. And now the ancient Moses is once again trying to encourage Israel to do what is right. It's kind of his last opportunity to set things right before he dies and Israel goes off under Joshua into the promised land. Deuteronomy chapter 7, we'll begin reading at the beginning of the chapter and finish up in about verse 3 or 4. Goes on to say here, or starts to say in verse 1, when the Eternal your God shall bring you into the land where you go to possess it and has cast out many nations before you. List a couple others here. The Hittites, but then also the Girgashites. The Girgashites had a throat problem. They went around, well, no, I'm just kidding. I don't know who the Girgashites were, to be honest, but they were obviously a pagan group, along with the Amorites, the Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. Verse 2, and when the Eternal your God shall deliver them before you, you shall smite them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. Now that might sound extremely harsh, and frankly it was. But what were these peoples involved with? It's an interesting study to find out what were the typical practices of these Canaanite peoples. There's a very good example in the scripture of one individual who was following these religions, sacrificed his son, and built his remains into the wall of the city that they were building. You see, you do this, God certainly, your God is going to protect this place because you've just given what's most important to you as a sacrifice to him. And you put it in this wall, so surely no enemy would be allowed to break this wall down. I mean, just sick practices. So God said, these people are so off base, I want them erased. Now, he'll bring them up in the second resurrection, and he'll give them an opportunity to learn and teach in a much better teach them in a much better environment than the one they went down in. So while it sounds very harsh, and yes, it is, it was a necessary solution for their benefit, that they'll come up in the second resurrection and be able to be taught. Verse 3, neither shall you make marriages with them. So the issue is pagan religious practices. The avenue or the wedge to bring that in is often marriage with a spiritual pagan, different religious practice altogether. So neither shall you make marriages with them. Your daughter you shall not give unto his son, nor his daughter shall you take unto your son. Why? Verse 4. For they will turn away your son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Eternal be kindled against you and destroy you suddenly. So that was the point. This intermarriage, this intermingling spiritually, would cause them great difficulty along the way. So it was clear then, if we go back to the book of Ezra, what Ezra was concerned about. He was concerned how these practices would begin to affect his people and affect the entirety of the people. We remember back at the time of Abraham and the punishment that would come upon Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham kept asking, well, if there were, 40? Wasn't that the number he started with? There are 40 righteous individuals in Sodom and Gomorrah. Would you still spare them for the sake of those 40? God says, well, yeah, if there were 40, I'd spare them. And you remember the story. Moses finally gets down. The only one I'm worried about is Lot. That was what he was implying. How about 5? Give me 5. Would you spare? The bottom line is God says, no, I'll take those out. So there is a threshold at some point where God says, I'm not going to spare for the sake of the righteous. I'm going to take the righteous out. And frankly, that's what will happen before the Great Tribulation. That unrighteousness will have increased to such a degree that God simply says, I'm going to destroy it. And I will take the righteous out to a place of safety to protect them while I take care of this business. Just like he took Lot and his daughters out to protect them for Abraham's sake largely. But he took them out until the punishment was passed. So Ezra was concerned. He saw this wedge amongst his people, and he saw how the influence would creep through. And before long, if leadership especially was allowed to continue in this way, here's where it would end up, in the same place it did during Jeremiah's time. Same place. We're committing idolatry. We're not worshiping God. We're breaking the Sabbath. And we're going to go into captivity. And this small nail hold, a small foothold in the promised land will be completely gone. And who knows whether our people really would have hope after that time. So you can understand his concern, a very valid concern, no doubt. So if we go back then to Ezra chapter 9, we read in verse 10, and now, O God, what shall we say after this? For we've forsaken your commandments. And we just talked about the commandments back in Exodus and Deuteronomy that he probably was referring to. Verse 11, which you have commanded by the servants your prophets, saying, the land into which you go to possess is an unclean land, with the filthiness of the people of the lands, with their abominations which have filled it from one end to the other with their uncleanness. Now therefore give not your daughters unto their sons, neither take their daughters unto your sons, nor seek their peace or their wealth forever. Just don't have anything to do with them. Now, why would people be doing this in the first place? People did these kind of things to ensure their survival. You see, we make a peace treaty with you. We exchange daughters. We exchange money. We begin this relationship. It's to preserve ourselves. What God is saying is that trust me for preservation. Trust me to take care of you. You don't need to enter into these kind of relationships to save yourself, to spare yourself. You need to trust me. And I think that's a principle that probably can be applicable for all of us at various times. We don't have to make a compact with evil to be able to survive ourselves. Some people think, well, I have to work on the Sabbath, otherwise I'll lose my job. And that may be true. But does that mean God will forsake us if we do lose that job? If we take a stand regarding God's truth? I don't think so. I don't think God would abandon us by any means. There may be trials ahead. There may be troubles ahead. But God's certainly not going to abandon us. We don't have to make a deal with the devil, as the saying goes, to ensure our physical safety or prosperity. Don't have to do that. That's what he's saying here. You don't have to trust in their agreements, the wealth with them. End of verse 12, that you may be strong and eat the good of the land and leave it as an inheritance to your children forever. Trust me. Don't trust in these agreements you make with others that, again, are often consolidated through marriages. Verse 13, after all that has come upon us, for all our evil deeds and for our great trespass, seeing that you, our God, has punished us less than our iniquities deserve, and has given us such deliverance as this. In other words, he's saying, since you've done such a great thing for us, we deserve to be completely wiped out. There's just this tremendous humble attitude among Ezra. We deserved to be completely wiped out. You've given us this small foothold here. You've shown us tremendous patience and grace. If you've done that, verse 14, should we again break your commandments and join in affinity with the people of these abominations? I mean, peace treaties, getting together, working these things out. Would you not be angry, in the middle of verse 14, with us, till you have consumed us, so that there should be no remnant or escaping? Ezra saw the wedge being put in. How that pagan practice would begin to infect Israel, or his people, Judah and Benjamin here. And he said, if this continues, it's going to be all over. We're going to be completely wiped out. There won't be a forgiveness next time. One time, I can forgive you. Second time, the same exact thing, as it says, probably not going to happen. So verse 15. O eternal God of Israel, you are righteous, for we remain yet escaped, as it is this day. In other words, God, you're so generous, so kind to us. Haven't we all uttered that kind of prayer? We go before God and say, God, I don't know why you put up with me. The fact that I'm still alive and here is a miracle, a testament to your graciousness. The rest of verse 15, behold, we are before you in our trespasses, for we cannot stand before you because of this. Verse 10, then, prayer is finished. Chapter 10, I should say, in verse 1. Now when Ezra had prayed, and when he had confessed, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, there assembled unto him out of Israel a very great congregation of men and women and children, for the people wept sore. Now obviously we're not given all the details of what was going on. But remember, Ezra arrives. A few months after he arrives, this delegation comes to him and says, we've got a problem. No one up to this point has had either the vision or the courage to address it. We need you to address it. Here's what's happening. Pagan practices are going on, and the way it entered our people is through these spiritual intermarriages. You've got to deal with this. So Ezra immediately starts praying about this. He's fasting about this. And while he's fasting, while he's praying, a delegation comes. I'm sure it was very encouraging to him that here's a whole host of people that understand, that get it, that really want to do what God says and are willing to stand up and be counted in this circumstance. That must have been very encouraging to him. When Ezra had prayed, verse 1, he confessed, weeping, casting himself down before the house of God. There assembled at the house unto him, I should say, of Israel, a very great congregation of men and women, children, for the people wept very sore. Now maybe some of them weren't aware of what was going on. Maybe they were, but maybe they're weeping now because they see hope. They see a leader in Ezra that will address this situation and begin to deal with it for everyone's sake. Now again, I'll pause here for a moment because in general terms, if this were today, what would people say? Relax. It's not involving you. If they want to go do these things, they'll pay the price. It doesn't involve you. Don't worry about it. Is that true? Not true. Remember the story of Achan? Achan was an individual back during the time of the fall of Jericho. Remember Achan? Where here Israel goes in, God performed this amazing miracle. Priests march around, trumpets are blown, walls fall down. Israel dashes in and just destroys the whole city of Jericho. Remember, one part of the wall stays up because Rahab lived there. She was faithful. But what happened? What do they say? When you go into Jericho, don't take a thing. It was the first victory, the first war in conquering the Holy Land. Don't take anything. Everything there is Corban. It's dedicated. It's to be wiped out. God doesn't want us getting rich off all these things that the pagans have stored up. So symbolically, everything they owned was dirty, spiritually speaking. get rid of it. Don't take it. Leave it alone. Whether it's gold, silver, clothing, whatever it is, don't take it. And you remember what happened. They go to the second battle at Ai. Much smaller city, much less fortifications. They send a group up there. The group from Ai comes out and smashes them. And Joshua says, what's the deal? God, you said you're going to give us this land. And he's crying in his breakfast cereal, which happened to be Captain Crunch, I'm sure, because he was the captain of the host at that point. What's the deal? You promised to give us this land. Now you turn your back on us. What's going on? And God says, "Dear Joshua, get up. There's sin involved here." Well, wait a minute. Sin involved? So what did they do? They sorted through, had each of the leaders of the tribes come by. One leader was chosen. It's somebody in your family. Leaders of the families came by. It was a certain family. Each of the heads of those households came through. Achan is pointed out as the one. What did Achan do? One person took of the forbidden things, gold, beautiful garments, stuffed them in his tent, thinking no one would know. So it wasn't until a number of individuals die in the battle at Ai that this sin comes out. So what was it? It was one person's sin that affected the entirety of the process of conquering the promised land. Caused the death of a couple dozen people. Now their wives are widows. Now their children are fatherless. One person. Ezra understood that. So do these other people. Oh, it's only a small group possibly. But it's still wrong. Just because it's a small group, does that make it all right? Say we overlook it because it's only a few? Not at all. If it's sin, it's sin. What would we say that about an infection in our body? Oh, it's just a small infection. I'm just not going to worry about it. Well, it might clear up, but what's the other side of the coin? It may spread like crazy. I only have one lice on my head. I think it'll be just fine. What's going to happen? I don't, by the way. At least that I know about. I don't think I have enough hair for them to hide it anymore. But anyway, do we just say, well, it's just a little bit. It's not going to be that big a deal. Of course not. So they realized that if this was allowed to continue, it would continue to spread, causing great difficulty for the people of God, and eventually would probably lead back to captivity. So they had to deal with it. But at this point, we're at 325. So we've been 40 minutes, a little over 40 minutes on the topic. So what we'll have to do is, since we're not going to obviously get through chapter 10, I think it'd be best to pause at this point. Next time we'll talk about how 2 Corinthians fits in, as well as Isaiah 52, into this next section, where Ezra actually deals with how we're going to deal with these spiritual intermarriages. So we'll call a pause there, and we'll pick it up with Ezra chapter 10 and finish up the book next time.